Welcome to Explain to Shane. I'm your host, Shane Tews at the American Enterprise Institute. On this podcast, I interview tech industry experts to explain how the apps, services, and structures of today's information technology system work and how they shape our social and economic life.
Welcome to today's podcast, where we delve into the complex world of spectrum management and the public policy challenges around the use of spectrum that is vital to our digital future. At the heart of this issue lies a fundamental tension. How do we manage the regulatory frameworks that could foster more innovation while ensuring the investment certainty needed for long-term infrastructure development? We discuss how flexible use policies on spectrum allocations continue to highlight the need for a more efficient process for spectrum allocations. We also talk about the need for a renewal of the spectrum pipeline by this Congress. Today, I'm honored to welcome Peter Rasavi back to this podcast. Peter is president of Rasavi Research, a consulting firm specializing in computer networking and wireless technology since 1993. With over three decades of experience, Peter has established himself as a leading voice in spectrum management and wireless evolution. Peter has authored more than 195 publications and has served as the executive director of the Wireless Technology Association for 16 years. His extensive work spans technical evaluations of cellular data services, Wi-Fi networks, and other mobile technologies. As a Stanford graduate with both a bachelor's and a master's degree in electrical engineering, Peter brings unparalleled expertise in analyzing spectrum requirements for mobile broadband and forecasting the future of wireless technology. Join us as we navigate these intricate policy landscapes that ultimately determine how our increasingly connected world functions. Peter, thank you for being a guest again today on Explain to Shane. You're one of my favorite guests. Every time I talk to you, I learn so much. It's just a pleasure to even just know you. It's great.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm pleased to be here.
Okay, thanks. So, you know, it's only March 5th when we're recording this, and there's already a lot that's been going on in Washington. But I'll have to give the House Energy and Commerce credit that while everyone else is still head scratching and figuring out how to manage the Trump administration, they got on it very quickly about spectrum pipeline. Something they have had many meetings with before. We got kind of stuck. We don't have a spectrum pipeline. So there's already been two spectrum-related hearings since the beginning of the year. In the most recent hearing, Matt Pearl, formerly of the National Security Council, and now he's over at CSIS, good for him, I'm excited to have him there, argued that making more licensed, full-power spectrum available will benefit national security, which is counter to what we hear a lot from our friends over that are DoD proponents that say that anything that has to do with national security means we need to step away and let them manage their spectrum however they want. So this is part of the challenge of spectrum management. But do you have any thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree with him that having a vibrant mobile ecosystem that includes extremely efficient and powerful mobile networks, as well as an app ecosystem, is critical to the security of this country. First of all, a stronger economy that is driven by these technologies is the foundation for stronger security. It provides the funding for defense systems, and it provides the technologies for these systems. But also, I think these networks provide critical infrastructure that must be under U.S. control and be completely trusted.
That's a really good point. So the FCC currently lacks the legal authority to auction any spectrum. It's something they let, unfortunately, go, and it's had a hard time getting Congress to let them have it back. So this actually also includes potential upper C-band, which is a mid-band spectrum range. If Congress restores the FCC auction authority but does not specify bands or deadlines, is that sufficient for the industry to secure the capacity that it needs?
Well, restoring that auction authority is a necessary first step. So that would be good. But I think without Congress actually stipulating how much spectrum and in what time frame, then we won't necessarily see movement in these auctions. So I do think it's essential that Congress get involved. And there are efforts to that effect, such as the Spectrum Pipeline Act that does specify certain amounts of spectrum that have to be auctioned within a certain time frame.
Yes, and of course we have the challenge. We have a lot of new members who are learning all about this. And part of the thing that I think, and a lot of things about technology, but very specifically about spectrum, is that innovation that's needed versus the regulatory certainty, especially for cost recovery. And that's one thing that people that do policy in general don't always spend a lot of time on the math side of the equation. The term spectrum sharing is widely used, but it encompasses multiple approaches. So let's just go through some of the different forms that are available for spectrum sharing. I know that the big one, let's start with the big one, is DoD. And part of that challenge is we don't exactly know what they're willing to share. We've had a little bit of an opportunity with that, but let's talk about the opportunity cost versus the opportunity risk there.
Right. Well, spectrum sharing is a big topic right now. It is one of the key elements of the National Spectrum Strategy. But it's important to note that a general purpose spectrum solution, a spectrum sharing solution today does not exist. Nonetheless, entities have shared spectrum throughout time. In fact, all spectrum is shared in the sense that you have simple geographic sharing, meaning that spectrum band is used in one place and then reused in another place. So that is a form of sharing. But the most complex forms of sharing are where you use the same frequencies more or less at the same time in the same location. One of our first attempts at that was with Citizens Broadband Radio Service, CBRS. And that effort started in 2012 and took 8 years before licenses were awarded. So that is one system that is currently in use. Proponents of CBRS have suggested that this is an approach that should be used for some of the bands under consideration in the National Spectrum Strategy, such as the band 3.1 to 3.45 gigahertz. The problem with CBRS, though, is that it's a simplistic approach, and really the technology at this point is obsolete, and there are much better approaches available today. And I can go into some of those.
Yeah, I mean, because it's interesting that you seem like it maybe was best current effort at the time that they created it, and even the possibility of sharing was pretty exciting. So we kind of maxed out that opportunity and technology moved on and we have better ways to do that now? Is that what you're saying?
First of all, CBRS has not been widely used because it is complex to use. It involves coordination between incumbents and the secondary users. There's a very complicated environmental sensing capability where secondary users have to rely on that to detect DoD operations. So that sensing capability is in question. There are proposals on how that could be improved. But also CBRS was specified to operate at very low power levels. And that means that anyone wanting to provide coverage over a wide area has to deploy something like 5 to 7 times as many cell sites as they would if it was cellular network running at full power. So there's that limitation. Also, it's a very simplistic approach in that it's either on or off, meaning that if the government needs to use those frequencies for a radar system, the network just has to stop using those frequencies entirely. There are much better approaches available today. One proposal is an approach called Active RAN, Radio Access Network, and that relies on the intelligence in today's networks with beamforming and rapidly adapting to the environment. So with an approach such as Active RAN, the network doesn't have to stop using those frequencies entirely. It can just reconfigure itself to not direct radio energy in a way that would interfere with the military systems. That would allow much more efficient use of the spectrum. So that's just one approach. But there's a lot of approaches on the table right now, and those are being worked at through the National Spectrum Consortium, of which I am a member. We can't really talk about what specific technologies have been proposed at this point, but there is a demonstration that is being planned for some of these new technologies, which I expect to happen sometime this year.
So the original example that was given to me talking about this probably a decade ago, was, military use, naval up in Boston. So you have, you know, aircraft carriers, ships, you know, that are coming in and out that use a certain spectrum. But as soon as they're out to sea, that's you could actually use that back on and land. And what I hear you saying is, so if they're sharing that spectrum, and then they realize that they're about ready to come into interference, and I hope that there's a buffer there, like, you know, ships coming in, that they immediately move to another band. Do I have that correct? That's how it was explained.
Well, that's the way it would work right now with CBRS.
Okay.
In that if the environmental sensing network, that's a distributed network of radios along the coast that listen for radar, military radar, and if they detect any use, then they inform the CBRS systems that those frequencies are no longer available, and then the commercial users have to turn off their use of those frequencies within 300 seconds.
Sometimes it sounds really great in theory, and you're not sure how well it works. But I was like, you know what? I'm from Nebraska. Maybe that particular area doesn't get a lot of ship traffic. Can we use it in Omaha and Lincoln? And I think the answer was yes.
Well, the interesting thing about those frequencies is that those rules apply to use of those frequencies in the United States, but there are countries around the world that are using those same frequencies that, for example, from 3.3 gigahertz on upward, that are in contention in the United States, but somehow the U.S. military is able to, or the Navy is able to use those frequencies just fine when they're at countries where commercial networks are using those frequencies, and there are no spectrum sharing systems in place in those countries. So that's one question that has been discussed.
And then the other thing is that they train on a certain band, and then they go to the theater, you know, an altercation, and use a different band. That's always kind of fascinated me. I mean, maybe there's a security element to that, but yeah. So I think the other thing is we also have just much more sophisticated technology. And so we need to keep the use of the spectrum band, I think, best current use, in upkeep with what is going on in the technology space. And that seems to be something that we don't do very well when we're talking about government use.
Yeah, the whole idea of spectrum sharing is, it's a very broad topic. And one important item to note is that every spectrum sharing solution that's been developed so far, and there are many, it's not just CBRS. For example, 5G can share spectrum with Wi-Fi networks in unlicensed bands. But that's a system, or that's a technology that was developed specifically for combining those two different users in those same spectrum bands. So the point I'm making is that every spectrum sharing solution today that's been deployed has been very specific to the users of those bands. So while it's very difficult to develop a really general purpose solution, there are a lot of techniques available for addressing specific use cases. And I think the best approach for spectrum sharing is to develop these techniques, but realize that for every situation, for every combination of users wanting to share spectrum, that a different approach might be needed. And what we need is a toolbox where we can apply different spectrum sharing technologies to address those particular scenarios.
That makes a lot of sense. And then the other ongoing debate is low power versus high power spectrum sharing approaches. And there seems like there probably is some trade-offs on that, but it's worth exploring. Can you elaborate for me on that?
There are entities involved in the spectrum sharing development projects, such as within the National Spectrum Consortium, that are advocating for low power. And the reason they say is that it can result in, you know, less interference between incumbents and secondary users. But I think that argument is fundamentally flawed, because what we really need are flexible solutions. And if you limit spectrum sharing to just low power use, then you end up with a situation such as CBRS, where if you want to provide broad coverage, you need so many cell sites that the solution is just not practical. It makes much more sense to develop spectrum sharing solutions that operate on a wide, or accommodate a wide range of power. Doesn't mean you can't then use it in a low power way, if you have, say, a secondary user or a commercial network operating close to a military system, it just means that you can accommodate a much wider range of use cases. As long as we're developing these new spectrum sharing technologies, we should do them in the most flexible way to make the resulting solution as effective for as many use cases as possible.
I mean, it's like, because part of the spectrum sharing is, it's, you know, people like, they understand finite things. And you're like, okay, well, how does it know when to be where and where to, you know, move itself around? And I just think that the actual, both combination of hardware and software probably are pretty good at that.
Exactly.
There
are fundamentally different approaches for spectrum sharing, or some of the tools used. And, you know, one is sensing. Now, CBRS uses a combination of sensing and databases, but in some scenarios, sensing alone might be sufficient. In other cases, a database-driven approach might be sufficient. Also, we should be thinking about it more flexibly, because right now, all the discussion, at least for the 3 gigahertz band, the lower 3 gigahertz band, is government as an incumbent with higher priority use versus secondary users such as commercial networks that would be lower priority. But in the future, there are likely to be situations where the sharing is among entities where there is not necessarily an incumbent, and the users might really have equal priority. So why not consider sharing solutions that accommodate different types of usage models? Also, we should be looking at exactly how each entity is using the spectrum, and based on their usage, the solution for sharing should accommodate their specific usage approaches. So that's why I say it's a very broad topic, and this is why it's so difficult to develop a really general solution. But that doesn't mean we can't become really effective at specific technologies or, you know, sub-technologies that allow us to create a solution for every specific scenario.
Is part of that challenge that it's a policy-driven solution versus an economic solution, where, you know, you find the best current use would probably be, there'd be some monetary element to that, versus saying any government entity always has right of way. They get first use.
Yeah, well, it definitely, policy comes into play. And so if it's a government system, then it typically is awarded, you know, higher priority. It's hard to argue with the notion that a system detecting an incoming missile should, you know, not have higher priority. So there are definitely obvious situations, but there are going to be less obvious situations where maybe it's a terrestrial network sharing spectrum with a satellite network, and it's not a mission-critical system. So, you know, the rules you come up with in that situation could well be different.
All right. Moving on to another topic, which you introduced me to, but let's just start for a little bit of the basics here. What is massive MIMO?
Massive MIMO refers to the ability to have multiple antennas or antenna elements working together to be able to shape the radio beam. And massive MIMO is used extensively today in 5G networks, and it really has been the key technology that has made 5G so effective in mid-band frequencies. So today's mid-band frequencies are, you know, mostly in the 3 gigahertz band, the C-band, and with massive MIMO, the benefit is that the multiple antenna elements allow the radio beam to reach a longer distance reliably, but it also allows simultaneous radio beams in a coverage area. So what you get from massive MIMO is not only increased coverage, but increased capacity. It has been extremely effective for 5G and really is one of the main technologies that has given us 5G networks with throughput rates in hundreds of megabits per second.
So one of the things we learned during one of the multiple COVID things was the ACP program. ACP is not coming to mind right now what it means, but you know, they said basically we're going to help fund you to stay connected, specifically really for internet use, you know, during COVID. And they found that given the choice and given the straight up dollar amount, more people chose to go with mobile over, let's say, connecting to a cable operation if they weren't already doing that. And I thought that was an interesting tell, and I think we've seen it, a lot of change in, you know, the industry since then, saying, okay, we got to figure this out. How are people using it? These mobile devices have become a full-on, you know, replacement for, a lot of people just don't care about sitting in front of, you know, a screen and television anymore. And so part of that has become this challenge about this, the area where the, you know, Wi-Fi spectrum is used. So Wi-Fi proponents argue that they need more spectrum than the cellular networks because Wi-Fi carries more of the actual data. So when you're hopping on and off the mobile system onto the maybe the cable system. So can you just kind of walk us through how that works and, you know, thoughts about that?
Sure. Well, my view on Wi-Fi spectrum versus mobile network spectrum is that both networks provide an equally important role. You know, Wi-Fi networks are extremely important. Wide area networks are extremely important. And we need both to provide us extremely efficient, high bandwidth connectivity. So right now the U.S. has a real imbalance between unlicensed and licensed spectrum in mid-band frequencies. There's actually more than three times as much spectrum right now available for Wi-Fi as there is for mobile networks. And I think that ratio just does not make sense. Wi-Fi proponents like to say, well, we carry more data over Wi-Fi networks than the mobile networks do. I think that's very misleading. It's kind of like saying, well, secondary roads in the United States carry 75% of the traffic. Therefore, they're more important than the freeway systems. And if congestion occurs on freeway, it doesn't matter because the secondary roads are where all the traffic is. So
interesting analogy.
Doesn't make sense in that regard.
Right. And so, you know, because I think that's one of the things that people love about the advent of things like Waze. Is, you know, you know in your head where is the easiest way to get from A to B, but when that little device starts telling you you should probably divert, you kind of pay attention to it because you're like, if I get in a traffic jam, it's going to be my own fault because it told me not to do that. And it's usually, you know, moving you around to a secondary place for your traffic to go.
There is this interplay right now that's going to become really crucial as we look at 6G. Which is that in the United States, the entire 6 gigahertz band has been allocated for Wi-Fi. The United States is the only, or one of the few countries that has done that. Most of the rest of the world has only allocated part of 6 gigahertz for Wi-Fi. Now, as we look for what is going to be the sweet spot for spectrum for 6G, and I should explain sweet spot as being those frequencies that provide the best balance of capacity and coverage. And in 5G networks, it's been the 3 gigahertz band. But for 6G networks, the critical band is going to be in the 6 to 7 gigahertz range. Most of the rest of the world is going to be looking at the upper 6 gigahertz band for the sweet spot for 6G operation. Meanwhile, we've given that whole band over to Wi-Fi. So there's also in the National Spectrum Strategy, we're looking at 7.1 to 8.4 gigahertz, which is the band above the 6 gigahertz Wi-Fi band. I expect, you know, a future battle for that spectrum, but I think it's going to be critically important for the United States to, because it doesn't have 6 gigahertz available for 6G, to make that 7 gigahertz band or a large part of it available for mobile networks.
So let's talk about the practicality of that, which is, I think about the Mobile World Congress is going on in Barcelona while we're taping this. And, you know, that's when you've got the hardware and the software guys trying to decide where they're supposed to be, you know, going on this. And you have this diversion between how U.S. operators are using the spectrum versus most of the rest of the world, which tend to be stay in sync with each other. Doesn't that cause us kind of an economic challenge of them building things to our networks, or are we okay with them having to do specific U.S. Purposes?
Well, the U.S. market is large enough to accommodate some amount of strangeness, but to the more you can be harmonized for spectrum across the world, the greater the efficiencies, the lower the cost of the chipsets and so forth. So there is a danger of doing, not doing what the rest of the world is doing. And I think the United States is stepping a little too far away from or not sufficiently prioritizing global harmonization.
So, yeah, it seems like the more we could kind of figure out the things that are valued and make sense versus having these spectrum fights. I'm not sure that the added cost of the spectrum discrepancy is helping the consumer.
No, not at all.
Okay, that's kind of the way it feels, at least. So what are there any other breakthrough capacities in 5G since you've been in this space for a really long time? Is there anything that they've been using it for that you weren't expecting or something that you're like, yes, this is 100% what they should be using it for?
The one area that's been extremely successful, and I think people anticipated it to some extent, which is fixed wireless access. Because 5G uses the mid-band frequencies so efficiently and provides such high performance, all the operators now are offering fixed wireless access, meaning essentially cellular service, but in a non-mobile fashion with at price points which are extremely competitive relative to, say, cable company broadband solutions. So that's been a real success story, and users seem to be extremely happy with the service. It rates extremely high in user satisfaction. So that's one area. I still think that 5G has a huge opportunity with Internet of Things, meaning non-humans involved at the endpoints. And 5G was designed to accommodate Internet of Things. The difficulty is that these applications require a lot of time to develop. It takes companies a long time to integrate, say, 5G connectivity into their operations. So the Internet of Things opportunities have not materialized as quickly as people want, but to me it seems inevitable. I think with 5G and then 6G, we're going to see a massive integration of 5G and 6G connectivity into the environment, into factories, just into everything that is around us.
Have we gotten rid of the fear factor? When 5G first came out, and it wasn't even, I mean, there were people just talking about it. It wasn't even implemented. And then they were all convinced that, the world was going to end. Now they've decided, I guess, maybe there's a different ending to the world. It seems like that eventually died down, and 5G works and everybody's happy with it. But the people that were concerned about it kind of lost interest because it didn't cause any of the problems.
Exactly. No, actually, I don't really hear about those concerns anymore. So that's a good thing.
Right. We're on a good path. So what should we be on the lookout for, Peter?
Well, I think there's lots to look forward to. One is we talked about massive MIMO, and that's now going to become, at least, some companies are calling it Giga MIMO, which is, as we can keep adding antenna elements, especially as we go up in frequency. And that means that the networks will be able to exploit higher frequencies. Right now, I mentioned before, the mid-band frequencies or lower mid-band, say at 3 gigahertz, is really effective. But there's no reason that with higher order MIMO that we can't use frequencies really effectively over wide areas that go into higher bands. That will translate to networks that are way more powerful than we have today. And one of the items we haven't discussed, and I think every podcast nowadays has to discuss, which is AI.
Okay. Oh, well, we thought we were going to make the whole thing. No, I love AI. Love it. Talk about it all the time.
I do think AI, it's not 100% clear on exactly what the impact will be on wireless networks, but I do see it resulting in much greater data being exchanged between users and networks. And we don't necessarily know all the applications, but it is likely to be a big driver for increased data usage.
So you mentioned the IoT applications for 5G. I just think of artificial intelligence just making them that much smarter, more efficient, and they can switch and talk to each other without having to have any sort of human intervention in that loop, unless there's something that that they need to know, that the machines will just do the smartest thing possible.
Hopefully.
I'm an AI optimist, so that's what I hope for, but yes.
No, I'm generally an optimist as well. I do read about the worst case scenarios.
There's always a doomer out there, right? Well, Peter, thank you so much for keeping us so informed. I appreciate having you in my treasure trove of people that I can go to and say, you know, explain to me what's going on, because this is a rapidly changing part that is so important to not only the digital economy, but just the economy overall. And it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. So I really appreciate you being a guest today on Explain to Shane.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Explain to Shane. For more episodes, subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred listening platform. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues to tune in. We'll see you on the next episode of Explain to Shane.